The guest today is G. Edward Griffin. He is an accomplished author and documentary filmmaker. He is the author of The Fearful Master, A Second Look at the United Nations, The Great Prison Break, The Capitalist Conspiracy, World Without Cancer, The Open Gates of Troy, The Grand Design, and of course, The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve System. And he is now in the middle of working on a new book entitled The Grand Deception, A Second Look at the War on Terrorism. Welcome, Mr. Griffin. Well,
thank you. It's good to be here.
Why do you call your book The Grand Deception?
Well, actually, the book is going to be called The Freedom Manifesto, and The Grand Deception is going to be a major part of the book. And the reason I've called that part The Grand Deception is because I think that there is a great deception going on regarding the motives, the agendas of the war on terrorism. And it's not a very happy picture. I wish I didn't see it that way. You know, it'd be so much simpler if you could just say, oh, everything's wonderful. It's exactly the way it seems to be on television and on the radio. We're over there in the Middle East to defend freedom. And isn't it all wonderful? It's too bad some people have to die. But after all, you know, it's necessary for the preservation of freedom. That'd be a very comfortable point of view. But unfortunately, the facts don't really point in that direction. And that's what I'm working on, because I think it's important for people to know that there are other agendas at work, and that these agendas are not nearly as praiseworthy as the defense of freedom or an attack against terrorism. And what I have come up with is perhaps the most horrifying conclusion of all, and that is that it's just the reverse. It's actually an attack on freedom in which it is necessary to defend terrorism now and then, to keep it alive, to keep terrorism as a specter and a threat, and to make it easy for terrorists to operate, to make sure we don't catch any of them, to make sure we don't, whatever happened to Bin Laden, we just can't seem to catch that guy. Oh, I wonder what happened to Hussein. Gee, these guys are so clever, they get away. In reality, it turns out that if you want to wage a war, you have to have an enemy, you have to have a hated enemy. And there's nothing that puts an end to the war drums faster than having defeated your enemy. So what I have come up with a hard conclusion, and this is not just an opinion, it's backed up by a lot of historical facts, that the war on terrorism is just the reverse of what it appears to be, and that's really what I'm writing about.
How could George W. Bush possibly come up with some grandiose scheme to deceive the world and create some different agenda than the one that they proclaim? He couldn't possibly be the mastermind of some plot?
Well, I don't think George Bush is the mastermind of the plot, but I do think that Mr. Bush belongs to a rather large group of people that have an affinity to each other because of a common ideology. It's not that they all belong to a secret organization or that they get together in a grand conspiracy and meet in the basement someplace under a bare light bulb and, you know, plot the destruction of freedom. No, not that at all. But they belong to a group of people who have a common ideology, and that ideology is collectivism. And that's a word that's not very, very familiar to the average American ear. We don't hear it very often, and we wonder, what is that? And that, too, is what I'm writing about, because, you know, people have to be motivated in their acts. And when people believe that, let's just say collectivism, since I mentioned the word, there are certain components of collectivism that make it a very compelling ideology for people to have. One of the components is that the group is more important than the individual, that the individual must be sacrificed if necessary for the greater good of the greater number. That's one of the cornerstones of collectivism, and it's a horrible conclusion. It sounds very appealing at first, but when you analyze it and you realize that, well, wait a minute, there really is no such thing as a group. The group doesn't exist. What is group? You can't touch group. You can't look at a group. You can touch individuals, and you can see individuals. But group is very much like the word forest. It's an abstraction. It's a word abstraction to mean many trees. So when you say the group has rights or has goals or has objectives which are above that of the individual, you're really you're in trouble, because if you're willing to sacrifice the individual for the greater good of the group, there's no such thing as a group. What you're really doing is just sacrificing some individuals for other individuals, and then those who are in charge of the group are the ones who are making the decision as to which ones get sacrificed, which ones don't, which is it's really a horrible philosophy to have, but it happens to be the philosophy upon which most of the governments of the world now operate, including our own. Now, the significance of that is that if you are part of this collectivist mentality and you really believe what I just said, then if you have some ulterior goal in mind which you think is worthy, then you can sacrifice untold numbers of people because they will be the minority. I mean, if you want to sacrifice a couple of thousand people at Pearl Harbor, for example, in order to get into a war, to put an end to all wars, which is what they said, well, then that justifies it, you see. You can sacrifice Americans, even if you're an American president. You can sacrifice a few thousand Americans if, in your mind, the ultimate goal is worth it. If we can get into a war at an opportune time, be in a position to alter the affairs of the world and create a new future that'll be better for mankind, then yes, now you feel good about doing these things, and it's not something that you have to be ashamed of. So I'm saying that this is the kind of thinking that's going on at the highest levels of our government. They are deceiving the American people, but they're not doing it to be mean or evil. They're doing it because in their own mind, they have something which they consider to be the greater good for the greater number. And once a person gets that idea clearly in mind, then all these other actions begin to snap into place. Now, you can disagree with them, and as I do, I don't think they've got it right. But the facts are that they are deliberately deceiving the American people, and history shows that American leaders on numerous occasions have been willing to lie and to deceive and even to sacrifice the lives of American citizens in order to accomplish some objective which in their mind was for the greater good of greater number. And I mentioned Pearl Harbor before. The reason that came to mind is because I've recently been going through all that history again, and I'm putting it into my book. And it's just an open and a shut case. Now, they used to deny that Roosevelt and Marshall and the highest members of our government and in the military used to deny that they had any prior knowledge of the Japanese attack and that it was a complete surprise. And as Roosevelt said, it was a day of infamy and all of that sort of thing. Well, now, gradually the pieces of the puzzle have bubbled up out of the mire of deception and secrecy and cover-up. And now it's also clear that the defenders of Roosevelt don't even attempt to deny it anymore. They now have switched their tune, and now they're saying, well, yes, it's true. He did actually not only know that the Japanese were coming, but he did everything possible to make it easy for them to come so that they would have a successful attack. They're saying, yes, and he withheld the information from Admiral Kimmel at Pearl Harbor and General Short. Yes, he did that. Everyone now agrees because the record is so clear, but now they think, but wasn't it a great thing that he did that? He was justified in doing so, you see, they say, because otherwise Hitler would have gone rampant all over Europe. He might eventually have attacked the United States. And so he had to do those things because the American people were too stupid. The voters were too ignorant to understand the importance of getting into that war. So, of course, Roosevelt had to violate the Constitution, he had to violate the laws, he had to kill a couple of thousand American citizens in order to bring the stupid American voters to the right point of view. Now, you see, this is what comes out of that mindset of collectivism, and it's the kind of thing we've dealt with in a lot of important stages in our history without even realizing it. And I'm hoping to pull this history together so that people can realize that this sort of thing has happened before. It happened in World War I with the sinking of the Lusitania. Woodrow Wilson and Colonel House and J.P. Morgan and all of those people were just itching to get the United States into World War I, and the American people would have no part of it. So they needed some kind of a dramatic event, and that was the sinking of the Lusitania. and they made that ship just as vulnerable as they could so that the Germans would sink it. The British pulled away their military escort at the last minute. There was the Lusitania, which had almost 200 Americans on board, steaming into hostile territory, and the Juno, which was a British destroyer, was supposed to safeguard it and go along with it and be on the lookout for German submarines. They pulled the Juno away, so the Lusitania now was undefended. The Lusitania had four boilers, was designed to be a very fast ship. It could outrun any submarine at the time. It was ordered as it went into those hostile waters to turn off one of its engines, to bank one of its boilers. So now it was running at 75% speed. And, you know, they did everything they could to see that that ship got sunk. It was the cause celeb they needed to inflame the passions of the American people to say, oh, yeah, look at those dastardly Germans. Look what they did. Let's get into this war. And it was all manipulated, and the history now is so clear on it. And I think, you know, once Americans realize that it's possible that these things not only can happen but have happened in two previous major wars, now it's a little different. You can look at current events maybe with the blinders off and realize, well, hey, there is a motive for this sort of thing. People are capable of doing this. Anyway, I've talked a long time on this thing, around it a little bit, but these are the kinds of things that I'm working on right now and pulling the history together. It's not hard to do. It's, as I said a moment ago, it's all clear. It's a matter now of public record. It's not a question of editorial opinion. And in many cases, the people themselves who participated in these acts wrote in their diaries about it. And now those diaries have been published. And many years after the fact, we can go to the diaries of Henry Stimson, for example, who was the Secretary of War under Roosevelt. And in his own diaries, he said, yeah, that's what we were doing. We were doing everything we can to get the Japanese to fire the first shot. He wrote in his diaries that we had to do it in such a way so as not to take on too much damage ourselves, but it was important to make it clear to the world that it was those bad Japanese that started the war. And he wrote this in his diaries. So, as I say, the evidence is now there, but unfortunately, it's not something you read about in the traditional history books, which have quite a different story to tell, and certainly it's not anything you hear on the major media. So that's my role. That's my job, to pull this together and to document it. Because, you know, when you say things like this, it's very unhappy news and people don't want to believe it. And I accept that as a challenge. I'm used to people saying, ah, I don't believe that. So I have to be doubly careful when I write these things and document the heck out of it. You know, I have to be to make my stuff bulletproof. So that's what I'm doing.
Sir, I'd like to ask you, I think there's a difference in the average man might agree that, yeah, okay, I've heard about that. Yes, they did know about Pearl Harbor beforehand. But the story that you often tell is the story of Cecil Rhodes and the roundtable groups that he created that sort of show a single causation for all of these events over the past 100 or so years. And I wonder if you could explain a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because people wonder, why do you talk about ideology, collectivism versus individualism? What's that got to do with anything, modern world? And the answer is, it has everything to do with current events in the modern world, because we're talking about the ideas that motivate men to act and motivate men to perform great acts involving whole nations. People who start wars or manipulate wars have a grand view of some future world that they want to see unfold. And that takes us back to, as you pointed out, to 100 years ago, to the very origin of this word collectivism. Don't need to get into all the dates and all the exact places and all of that, but it's an idea that started really in Europe. Karl Marx was right at the forefront of it. He developed the concept of collectivism, that the group is more important than the individual, and that the rights, human rights, don't come from the individual, or from a divine origin. Human rights are granted to the individual by the state. All of these concepts were part of a package in which an individual came to the conclusion that the state was the ultimate mechanism of society and that all good things were going to happen because of a powerful state. And this idea grew up in Europe about the time Karl Marx was writing it, but he wasn't the only one. There were a lot of them, but he's the one that survived, and his writings survived. But at the same time, in England, there was another group called the Fabians, and they're still in existence today. The Fabian Society began to write the same concepts as Karl Marx. In fact, a lot of them considered themselves to be Marxists, but they were very offended by the style of Marxism that we now call communism. When Lenin added his ideas to Marx, that fused together and became what they call Marxism-Leninism. And it sounds like a funny, bunch of words, blah, blah. What does that mean? Well, it means a lot to the people that call themselves that. A Marxist-Leninist, if you ever met one in person, as I've met many of them and talked to them about it, they will tell you that they are a Marxist because they believe in the collectivism of Karl Marx, as explained in Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto. But they're a Marxist-Leninist because they also believe in the teachings of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. And Lenin said, basically, he said, comrades, it makes no difference what you think or what you know or what a good debater you are or how wonderful your utopia is or the future. None of that matters unless you come to power. The only thing that matters is to come to power. Do whatever you have to do, even betray your own ideas, lie, cheat, steal, murder, kill, if anything, to come to power. He said, if you have to convince people that you are an anti-communist, then convince them of that so you can come to power. And then after you're in power, you can let them know what the real story is.
Like Richard Nixon.
Well, yeah, it's not unique to Lenin, but Lenin was really a master at it, He's a very quotable guy. He said, promises are like pie crusts made to be broken. I mean, this is Lenin. And he made an art out of that. And so when you hear a person say that they're a Marxist-Leninist, you have to understand that's what they're talking about. They're really saying that they will do anything, including putting up a false appearance to be something they're not, in order to come to power. Once they're in power, Lenin said, then you always win the debates because if they don't agree with you, you can execute them. Right on. So anyway, the Fabians, and the reason I went into this is because the Fabians believed the same thing, but they were a little bit offended by the brutality of Lenin, and especially when Lenin took Russia and then followed by Stalin, and there were the purges and all of the executions and the bloodbaths, which are sort of a logical extension of this concept of collectivism, because after all, don't forget, the greater good for the greater number. So if you have to kill a million people or 10 million people, that's not so bad. If there are 11 million that you're doing it for, it's kind of a numbers game, But anyway, the Fabians were very offended and shocked by the brand of collectivism that they saw taking root in Russia, that brand called communism. And so they said, no, we're going to distance ourselves from that. We're going to do the same thing, but we're going to be more genteel. Our collectivism will not be brutal, and there won't be bloodbaths, but we'll have the same thing. We'll still have the same absolute state control over society and individual lives, because that's what we believe in. So you have to understand that history, that in the beginning there were many groups of collectivists, but the only two that really ever amounted to anything, the anarchists dropped out of the way, the syndicalists dropped out of the way, there were little groups, they all disappeared except for the Leninists, who continue to this day, and the Fabians, who continue to this day. And it's important to know that history, because our side of the world is firmly in the hands of Fabians. They believe essentially the same thing as the Leninists, but they believe that they will be more genteel, and they don't preach violence, and they don't preach brutality. But as far as what they want in the future, it's exactly the same. They want collectivism. They want the super state. They want world government. And they will fight with each other like dogs and cats over who will be the top person in the pyramid of power in the future world government based on the collectivist model. They'll compete with each other for dominance and power, and they may even send armies into the battlefield to fight with each other for geographical dominance, as they're now doing in the Middle East. But they always cooperate with each other over the long-range goals. They both believe in world government on the collectivist model. And so you find the two factions in the United Nations today, the so-called disunity that we see at the UN, is not a fight over the role of the UN. Both sides are always calling for more power to the UN, but what they're fighting over is which side, the Leninists or the Fabians, which side are going to be the dominant force in that coming world government. And once you understand this history, then all of these confusing components in the world stage today, all the pieces of the puzzle that don't seem to fit, snap, they go right together.
So where does that involve Cecil Rhodes and the roundtables?
Oh, well, thanks. I skipped over that.
That's
I?
Okay.
Yeah, I get so wrapped up in this. Well, Cecil Rhodes, let's see, at the time that Karl Marx was writing all of this and developing these concepts, one of the most eloquent spokesmen for collectivism was a brilliant academic by the name of John Ruskin. He was a professor of fine arts at Oxford University. And he taught collectivism in his classes. He was very eloquent about it. I've gotten hold of some of his lectures and his books, and I've read them. I was prepared not to like the guy because he was such a bloody collectivist. But he was quite brilliant and very artistic, very creative. And he taught collectivism. And don't forget, at Oxford now, that means that the students there were from the upper class in British society. They were the wealthy upper class. And a lot of them had a guilt complex over their privileged position. And they could look around the world and see so much poverty, and they'd see the downtrodden people, and they felt kind of guilty about that. And so they were very receptive to the message from John Ruskin, who said, all right, you are the privileged class. You have inherited the great culture of our age. It is your responsibility, if you want to help these starving and downtrodden people, it's your responsibility to create collectivism. And you can run the collectivist state. You can now be the benefactors. You can make sure that these people have a better life, and you can still retain your wealth and your privilege. And you can now feel good about it, you see, which was part of the appeal. That's one of the reasons that the daughters and the sons of the privileged often fall for the socialist line, because it's kind of a way for them to salve their conscience that they have so much. And at the same time, now they can go into government work or advocate collectivist systems where they can be in charge of society. And, of course, in that position, they'll still have their privileged status. So, anyway, John Ruskin taught that, and he taught it very well. And one of his students was Cecil Rhodes. Cecil Rhodes apparently really took it to heart, and his friends say that for the next 20 or 30 years of his life, he often would take the notes out that he made when he was John Ruskin's student, and he would read them and use them for points of discussion. Cecil Rhodes, your listeners may not realize or remember quite the name, how it ties up, but he was one of the wealthiest men in the world, made a fabulous fortune in South African diamonds and later in gold. He practically owned all the natural resources of South Africa, and he just made one of the great fortunes of history. But what they don't realize is that he spent that money to create a secret society. A secret society by his own will. There have been books written on the wills, the seven wills of Cecil Rhodes. One of the things he did in one of those wills was to create the Rhodes Scholarship. And that's well known. People know about Rhodes Scholarships. President Clinton, for example, was a Rhodes Scholar. But what they don't realize, in the other wills, he created a secret society for the whole purpose of promoting collectivism as taught by John Ruskin. Promoting collectivism and to create a world government built on the model of collectivism. That's where all of that money of Cecil Rhodes went. And there are some very solid histories on this, written not by critics of Cecil Rhodes, but by supporters of Cecil Rhodes, who explain all this.
For example?
Carol Quigley, who was a professor at Georgetown University, is probably the best historical source, because Quigley found nothing wrong with this, and he wrote a couple of books. So one of them was Tragedy and Hope. He says in his books that he was permitted to study the secret documents of this organization, this secret society, for many years. And he said, I find nothing wrong with it. I have no aversion to it. The only disagreement he ever had is that he disagreed that they should remain secret. He thought they should be proud of what they were doing. So a lot of the things we know about this organization comes from Quigley, but he's not the only one, of course. But I would recommend, if somebody wants to get into serious research, they get hold of Quigley's books. One is Tragedy and Hope. Now I've got to go to my bookshelf here and take a look at the other one. It's the British Establishment, I think that's what it was.
The Anglo-American Establishment?
Thank you, the Anglo-American Establishment.
And the picture on the cover is the Union Jack with the American flag upside down and submerged within it.
You've got it. I've got it in my hand. That's it. And between those two books, you'll find just about all the history you could probably stomach on the secret society. But anyway, Quigley tells us that the secret society is still very much in existence today. And he explains that it was built along the usual conspiratorial lines of some of the better-known conspiracies of history, such as the Illuminati. And I know somebody will say, do you think the Illuminati still exists? I have no idea, but I know it did exist because their papers have been, were seized, and they're a matter of historical record. But in any event, Quigley tells us that the Rhodes Secret Society was set up along those lines with rings within rings within rings, meaning that there were layers of organization, and each outer layer was not to be aware that they were controlled by an inner ring. So at the very center, you might have three people, let's say, that start the whole thing, and then they have it around them maybe 20 or 25 people, and those 25 do not realize that there are three that really control. And then around the 20, you might have one that's 500 members, and those 500 think that they're the whole shebang. They don't realize that there are 20 that really have been given the job to control the 500, and so forth. And that's the way a lot of the old traditional secret societies were formed. That's one of the ways they kept their secrets. So anyway, this organization was created that way, and Quigley tells us in plain language that about the third ring out, they created something in New York called the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, wham, we're right into current history, because if you take a look at the movers and shakers in American politics today and in American society today, you'll find that about 80% of the key figures are held by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, isn't that interesting? Now we're in, all of a sudden, this begins to tie up, and you can realize that the world, the American world at least, is being directed primarily by a group of people who do not realize that they're being controlled by inner rings, or that there is some ulterior motive or other agenda. They don't know that. Very few of them do, I should say. A few of them probably do. But they're all brought together and carefully selected because they share an ideology called collectivism. And they're useful for that purpose. If they believe in collectivism and they have the goal of world government, they can then come to the point of view, world government along the collectivist model, they can then be brought to the point of view that whatever we have to do to move the world in that direction is for the greater good of the greater number. And yes, even if we have to lie to the American people, even if we have to pretend to conduct a war for one purpose, when in reality it is for another purpose, even if we have to, tragically, sacrifice a few thousand American lives for the greater good of the greater number, then let's get on with it. So it's impossible for people to understand today's history without understanding this old history of how we got here from there.
Sir, generally through history, the Council on Foreign Relations has shied away from too much publicity besides their own journal, Foreign Affairs. But after September 11th, we've seen the Council on Foreign Relations members all over the media. Anytime if someone gets in their car and turns it to National Public Radio, the expert is the expert because he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And I wonder, what do you make of that, the CFR moving into such a public role?
Well, I don't know what to make of it. I think it's a mistake on their part. But I have to conclude that they are so confident that nobody will ever figure out what I've just been talking about, that they can do it with impunity. I think the only parallel I can think of is with the Federal Reserve System. You know, when I wrote the book on the origin of the Federal Reserve, one of the interesting facts of history I uncovered was that when the Federal Reserve was created in secret back in 1910 on Jekyll Island, the participants at that meeting denied for many years that they were there. They just said that no such meeting took place. And it wasn't until quite a few years after the Federal Reserve was written into law and had become accepted by the American people as a great American institution, only then did they start to reveal the fact that, yes, they were there at the meeting, and, yeah, they discussed this. And finally, they started to write books about it, and it got to the point where I guess they were vying with each other for praise for having been the most important person at the meeting. And it all came about because of the change in public attitude in accepting the Federal Reserve as a great American institution. So I'm thinking that there might be a parallel there, that now they think that being a member of the Council on Foreign Relations will be so prestigious in the minds of the average American that saying, oh, I'm a member of the CFR, all of a sudden opens doors to the common man, or at least open doors to his mind. I think it's a mistake, because when you can show, as you can, and I've been talking about, this is not something I'm making up, this is solid history, and it comes right from the people who are participating in these things themselves, not by critics. And when you can show that the things I've said are true, I think being a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in the distant future is not going to be something that's going to add to your prestige.
Sir, as an alternative to world government, you know, the average human only lives maybe 70 or 80 years, and it seems, and if history is going to go on forever, can we really legitimately have a policy of mutually assured destruction as the only means of guaranteeing freedom and checks and balances on Earth? Many people would say that regardless of whether these people are collectivists or Rhodes Scholars or Skull and Bonesmen, that world government is inevitable because the only other solution, the acronym, is MAD. And surely we can't have all these different nations armed with hydrogen bombs forever.
Well, that's a common argument. It has the ring of logic to it, but there are a lot of flaws with it. First of all, let's just talk about world government. There's nothing wrong with the concept of world government in a generic form. The question is, what kind of government? Does anybody ever stop to ask that? Could you imagine a kind of world government that Adolf Hitler wanted, for example? Why did we fight Adolf Hitler? He wanted world government. If we thought world government was such a good idea, we should say, okay, Adolf would be as good as any. Let him run the whole thing, and nobody will be shooting each other anymore, because if you stand up against Hitler, he'll just blow your head off. So nobody will object. The idea of any kind of a world government being the solution to weapons of mass destruction is itself insane, because the only reason we want to put an end to war is to put an end to destruction and human misery and slavery. Well, if you adopt a certain kind of world government that's based upon destruction, human misery, and slavery, what's the difference? You know, you get it without war or with war. I think we need to focus on the question, what kind of world government? And that we're back to ideology again. See, if we accept collectivism as the ideal form of government or the organization of society, we are accepting totalitarianism. But there is another alternative, and that is individualism. And it's just the opposite of collectivism on every issue. And under a concept of individualism, you can have a world government where people live together in peace and brotherhood, but it would be in the absence of coercion. In the absence of coercion. Now, you say, well, what's to stop somebody from dropping a bomb on you? Well, if you lived in the old West, you know, everybody had a gun strapped to their side. And every once in a while, there'd be some bandit come along, and he'd use his gun, and he'd rob you. But, you know, I've seen some interesting studies on that. They say that the average person was more safe in the Wild West, where everybody was carrying a gun, than he is now in New York or Chicago downtown, because they had guns and they could protect themselves. I think the problem is that we want some kind of utopia. Everybody's looking for that magic formula whereby absolutely there could be no risk, no danger, nothing could ever go wrong, and that's not human nature. That's not the way the real world is. I think looking to the best kind of government that we can have, world government or otherwise, it is one in which there is obviously some kind of risk that some kind of an insane person would go off the deep end and use a weapon of mass destruction. But I think it's better to run the risk of an aberrant individual, a criminal mind, occasionally possibly doing that, than setting up a world government where you take the most criminal minds in the whole world and put them in charge of the only stockpile of weapons of mass destruction there is. Because now you know you're going to have it used. And you're not going to have it used in the form of war. You'll have it used against any group that dissents. And they won't call it war. They'll call it peacekeeping. See, what I'm trying to say is that if you're looking for a magic formula to absolutely guarantee that no weapon of mass destruction could ever be used, I don't think you're ever going to find that. But realistically, you certainly don't want to take the criminals of the world and give them the only supply of weapons of mass destruction. And that's what the present world government is shaping up to be.
Sir, you've already given me over 20 minutes more than you promised, so I'd like to only ask you just one more question. What can the average American individual who does care about liberty do in order to preserve it in these perilous times?
Well, that's a really good question, and in fact, that's what I'm really working on. The reason I'm trying to get this book finished, Freedom Manifesto, is not only just to bring out the historical facts that I'm talking about, and not only to offer a superior ideological replacement for collectivism, which would be individualism, but to introduce people to an organizational effort where they can do something about it. It doesn't make any difference what you know, Lenin said, if you don't do anything with that knowledge. And that's one point where you have to agree with Lenin. Lenin was a doer. But instead of trying to mobilize people and to create an organization to capture control of society and take away people's freedoms, I think we need to get people organized and learn how to become influential in society and capture whatever control you can in order to preserve freedom. And so we have created an organization called Freedom Force International, and that is a huge topic in itself, is how you can do this. But the bottom line is we've got to show people how to become influential in organizational work, how to become influential in civic organizations and political parties, labor unions, church organizations. This is how we've lost our freedom, is because all of these organizations that make up the sum total of power in a nation have been taken over and captured at the top by people with a collectivist mindset. And it's time for those of us who have an individualist mindset to go into those organizations and try and see if we cannot get control back away from them. And so if anybody's interested in participating in this great work, and I hope there will be many of them who are, I urge them to come onto our website. And everything is there, and it's a real easy website to remember. It's Freedom Force. Now, there's a hyphen in there because putting it all together was already taken. So it's freedom-force.org, not com, but org. So it's www.freedom-force.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Weekend Interview Show interview with G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve, and the upcoming book, The Freedom Manifesto. Thank you so much.
Thank you.